Welcome here to episode 25 of the Chat New England podcast. I'm Nick LaRock, and I am joined, as always, by Ben Babcock. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you joining me early on the Saturday morning, all the way out from the West Coast. But I'm doing good, man. I'm doing good. It's a rainy day, slushy out here, typical March New England weather. So it's good to be on the couch talking some sports.
Yeah, it's supposed to be 75 and sunny here today, so if we could hurry this up, that'd be great.
Fair enough.
Hey, before we dive into Patriots offseason stuff here, I gotta tell you, I've been having these strange thoughts all week. Not really sure where they came from.
Let's hear them.
But don't you think that at some point here, or maybe we should have already had this, Meatloaf ought to be doing the Super Bowl halftime show?
You're preaching to the choir on that one, man, because I don't think that there could be maybe a better performer, better suited for that type of situation because of the theatrics that are already built into his performance. And every one of his songs is like a medley of sorts. You know, there's a lot of changes. There's a lot of different pieces to the puzzle. It's almost perfect for what they do at the halftime show, right? Because you can't just come out and sing four or five songs. You've got to have the transitions, and that's something that just comes very naturally.
Yeah.
I think that would be awesome, personally.
Every one of his songs is like a Chinese buffet. You just get like a little bit of everything, you know? And like you said, the theatrics, I mean, it's like every show – he plays is already the Super Bowl halftime show in a way. You know?
It really is. Man. It really is. Yeah. I don't know if you remember this, but in college, I actually found a Bad Out of Hell tour T-shirt, Meatloaf concert tour, and I used to wear it out occasionally. I wore it to the dining hall one time, and one of the servers was like, "Hey, man, that's an awesome shirt," and I was like, "Oh yeah, thanks." I thought she was kidding. She was absolutely dead serious. She gave me one of those looks, like a nod, like, you know, I imagine what it's like when, you know, like when the Navy SEALs killed Bin Laden, the same sort of affirmation, steely-eyed stare that I received from this server at the dining hall on the count that I was wearing a Meatloaf Bat Out of Hell Tour T-shirt, probably around this time on a Saturday morning, probably looking a little bloodshot in the eyes, a little worse for wear, but hey, if they can make it happen, I think it would be amazing. Unfortunately, I don't think that the NFL or the people running the halftime shows really have any appreciation for Meatloaf, which is unfortunate because I think it would be a good thing for the game.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously, they finally got it right this past year with the Madonna show. So it'd be nice to see that continued. And I would think it'd be nice if it could happen in New Orleans this year because, you know, he's kind of a weird dude. I feel like you could really get this show going where it's lots of theatrics, but it's kind of dark at the same time.
Yeah, he'll do the whole Phantom of the Opera or like Beauty and the Beast type theme thing that he does in his videos.
Yeah, and maybe get a little black magic kind of thing going on there. So anyways, that would be great because you got to figure the year afterwards when it's at MetLife Stadium in New Jersey, you got to figure – you know,
that's going to be Springsteen, right?
I was going to say, if I could take a bet, that's either Springsteen or Bon Jovi. I'd put my life on it, you know?
So. Yeah. Has Springsteen done it recently?
Yeah, Springsteen did. I want to say it was Cold Saints, which all is right, yeah. The only reason why I think it could be Bon Jovi, because I think that if Springsteen hadn't done it yet, I mean,
right, that's a no-brainer, right? I mean,
yeah, at that point, I think none of us would have ever thought that Giant Stadium would have gotten a Super Bowl because of the weather there. But I think if he had known that, then he would have held out for that. So we'll have to see what happens.
Yeah. Well, you know about what Bill Belichick will be voting for.
Is he a Springsteen guy?
No, man. He's a huge Bon Jovi fan. You didn't know that?
Oh, Jesus.
He's like Bon Jovi goes to like their practices in the preseason, sits in the box with Kraft. He's tight with Bon Jovi.
Really?
I thought that was common knowledge, honestly. But Belichick makes the players listen to like Bon Jovi, like Slippery When Wet, during practices and stuff, and walkthroughs in the stadium. like when they practice for crowd noise, I'm pretty sure they play like live Bon Jovi concerts over the loudspeakers, crank it up to 11, and you know, they're playing Living on a Prayer, you know.
Oh my God! Well, I guess, you know, Slippery and Wet and all of that stuff, I guess that's not so offensive, but certainly some of the more recent stuff. I'd vote for Springsteen anyways. That's what I can say.
Well, I would too, although I have been to a Bon Jovi concert. I'm not ashamed to admit it. And it was an experience, I'll tell you.
Yeah. Well, my biggest thing is, you know, the faster these guys age, the worse and worse and sort of more sad their shows become. So we need to get Meatloaf sooner rather yep. than later. So if you're listening and, you know, you can find any way that you can send your input to the NFL, we want Meatloaf doing the halftime show in New Orleans, Super Bowl 47.
Heard it here right. first.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about the Patriots now. But one thing we should try to hold off for the end of the show is interesting reports all saying that, you know, the Saints and Drew Brees are having a little bit of trouble with their negotiations. You know,
I would think so. And I don't know, maybe we'll touch on this, but apparently there's some things coming out about New Orleans players headhunting and paying each other for injuries caused. So that's an interesting story that's just kind of developing down there right now.
But I don't think they must have paid very much money because that defense is terrible.
Well, listen to this. I guess this is not necessarily this season, but this is just coming up on Twitter right now. But I guess Adam Schefter on NFL Live is reporting that in the week of the NFC Championship game, I guess this must have been two years ago against
Minnesota.
3 years ago, Minnesota. Vilma put $10,000 on the table and said, "This goes to the guy that knocks out Brett Favre." So that's leaked out somehow.
Wow.
I think that's awesome, personally, because I hate Brett Favre. But, and you know, but that's pretty that's tough PR for the Saints right now, that's for sure.
Bernard Pollard would clean up for them. That's where he
got to go. he's an obvious free agent pickup for them. He is an unrestricted free agent right now.
But the Drew Brees thing, I mean, you know, it's interesting because I think that team was so well built last year. Offensively, the offensive line is so good. The receiving core was so deep. And, you know, they're talking about him. And, you know, I know this always happens whenever a star quarterback is – I mean, it was Eli Manning at one point, and Drew Brees is probably going to end up being the highest paid player in the history of the NFL, you know, until the next guy comes up.
Yep.
And, you know, they're talking $18, $19 million, and they're talking about them not being able to maybe bring back a guy like Carl Nix, some of their studs on the offensive line, and just how in the future that could really hurt them. I don't know. I always think it's interesting – I mean,
it's
you know,
tough, right? Because – and you had emailed me about this week, so I've been thinking about it. But it's like, you know, if you're a star quarterback and say you command the amount of money that Brees is likely to get or that a guy like Peyton Manning got or that Tom Brady got, if you consider yourself an elite franchise quarterback and Brees certainly has the numbers and the credentials to back that up, you got to feel on the one hand like you should be paid – what you deserve. You should be paid like one of those guys. But at the same time, it has to be in his mind that if the Saints pay him that money, then there's going to be a good portion of the team they won't be able to pay. So almost by accepting that enormous contract, you're kind of, you know, you're sinking the ship, so to speak, in terms of what they can do for personnel. And particularly when you start talking about the offensive line, it's really almost shooting yourself in the foot. If you go out and sign a huge deal and then everybody that was blocking for you the year before gets released.
Yeah, I think they were saying it's Carl Nix and then Jabari Evans that's going to be up too. And, you know, I guess what it is for me is it seems like it's one of these things where, sure, I understand that, you know, you want to make as much money as you can. And, of course, everybody does, and that is what it is. But then you hear these guys always talk about how badly they want to win. And, you know, it seems to me like if you're Drew Brees, certainly if the Saints were not a contender and if they, you know, if it seemed like it was really just him who had been bringing them success and they weren't such a deep team, yeah, of course, then you just try to get your money. But this is a case where it's like, you know, I mean, this is a team that is legitimately scary for next year if they are able to come back reasonably intact. And it just seems to me like, you know, they all talk about how all I want to do is win, and that's what drives me, and that, you know, I'm wired to want to win no matter what game I'm playing and all this stuff. And I'm thinking to myself, well, I mean, you could take $13 million a year, and that would be probably the best thing you could do to help your team win, you
right.
know? And but, you know, that none of them do that. And so I don't know. It's just an interesting thing to think about. I mean, when you look around, and, you know, it happens in all sports. You know, you look at a guy like Kobe Bryant who's making $24 million. You look at, you know, the kind of money that
– The NBA is crazy. I mean
– Yeah.
The NBA is crazy. I mean, you look at, like, a guy like Carlos Boozer is making $15 million a year in the NBA.
Right.
You know? I mean – That's insane. I mean, that's as much as, like, the best quarterback in the NFL, you know?
Right. And, you know, I do think at the highest superstar level that, you can make an argument that a Drew Brees, a Tom Brady, a Kobe Bryant, a LeBron James, you can make the argument that those guys are actually underpaid when you look at how much money their teams make from them.
Right.
But I agree with you that in the NBA.
It's different, though, too. There's only five guys on the court at one time.
Right.
Right. So a superstar player in the NBA, by that rationale, has a much larger impact on the game potentially than one of 22 guys on the field at any, you know, given time in an NFL game.
Right.
So I could see that too. And, you know, but it is something to consider. I mean, I think you have to take into consideration the situation with Peyton Manning right now too. Now, does a guy like Brees say, listen, if I sign this huge deal and I go out and get hurt next year, am I going to be protected? Or but at the same time, if I take a smaller deal to help my team and forego some guaranteed money or some kind of bonus or a lesser salary so that they can go out and re-sign these guys, what's to say that they won't just release me next year if I get injured? And then I've missed this opportunity, which is a once-in-a-career, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for him to cash in on his, you know, his history of success, his potential for in the future, and you know, so I think this what's going on with Manning is going to kind of change how some of these guys think about these things potentially going forward. I mean, I'm not sure how flexible the teams can be with guaranteed money, and you know, that's one of the things they always move around to say, hey, all right, we'll give you a $30 million bonus, but we're only going to pay you $12 million a year, so it's going to average out to 18 a year, but. You know, in terms of the salary cap hit in the next few years.
Yeah, and they can get really creative with that, like you said. I mean, I know DeBrickashaw Ferguson just restructured his deal so that, like, he's only getting paid, like, $1 million this year. But he's getting, like, $8 million as a signing bonus or something like that. It's like,
right.
You know what I mean? And I don't know. Even with Drew Brees, you could even maybe take a lesser deal but make sure that more of it is guaranteed so that that's not something you're worried about. I mean, it just seems like, you know, again, I get it. I get it in the sense that you want to make as much money as you can and you have such a short career. And, you know, in Drew Brees' case, you know, he certainly earned this coming back from injury and
yep.
having to leave San Diego and all of that. But it just – I always think it's interesting, and the thing I wonder the most is, you know, if it was just Drew Brees and he didn't have any outside pressure, if he might be more willing to say, sure, why don't we work something out? Why don't we say $14 million a year, $13 million a year? You guys guarantee 70% of it, or, you know, however it has to work so that you can keep this team intact. Right. But then I have to wonder what kind of pressure is coming from the players union and from
right.
You know what I mean? And saying, yeah, you know, no, exactly. We need to keep driving this thing higher and higher. You know, there are only so many guys who can keep, I mean, when you hear highest paid player ever, and then you have the next guy coming up who should be that, you know, they keep driving each other's numbers higher. And when, you know, all it takes is a few guys like a Drew Brees to say, no, you know what? I want my owner to be able to make this team the best contender that it is, so I'm gonna be willing to take a little bit below my value, and you know, and then that hurts everybody. So I gotta right. wonder what's that? What kind of factors are at play there?
Right. I mean, and the league has, to their credit, I feel like the NFL with their salary cap and the way they handle things, and particularly what they did with the CBA and restructuring the way that rookie contracts are structured, and then the guaranteed money is allocated for those. That's going to go a long way with keeping the parity in the league, you know, pretty balanced across the board. But yeah, I mean, it's like you said, there is going to be pressure for Drew Brees to take a maximum deal. And just like, you know, and those other, the linemen, Nicks and Jabari Evans, is that the other guy?
Yep.
Okay. I wanted to say Jabari Greer. Cause there's only so many Jabaris out there, kicking around the NFL. But, you know, and those guys are also going to be getting pressure to go out and get big contracts at their positions as well. So, you know, and who's to say that New Orleans can make it all work? I mean, this is what makes the NFL offseason so interesting, I think, is because, you know, with a salary cap, unlike baseball, where they can just keep going out and spend and spend and spend, or on the other side, not spend at all and just say, well, whatever, we'll just roll out this crap team and see if we can give away tickets to the games at the local Wendy's. You know, there's a lot of maneuvering that goes on, and that'll kind of lead me into, I guess, my take on the Patriots offseason here, because the Patriots are in a really good spot in terms of their salary cap numbers. They had the eighth lowest salary cap figure in 2011. And going into 2012, they're in pretty good shape. Most estimates put them at around $20 to $23 million under the cap at this point. And they also have the potential to borrow money from either the cap in 2013, or they can use whatever money they didn't use in 2011, they can apply that as well towards the next year's cap. So there's a little bit of room where they can actually probably squeeze another $7-8 million out of their cap space for the upcoming season, which should put them in a pretty good situation, because obviously the biggest name that's on their free agent list this offseason is Wes Welker. And we're coming right up to the deadline. They're thinking he'll probably have to be franchised. I believe it's March 5th. And then the 13th is the beginning of the free agency signing period. If I'm not mistaken. So Welker, you know, if they franchise him, if they can't work out a long-term extension, they're going to be looking at about $9.4 million. So you apply that towards the cap space that they have, and that's going to leave you with anywhere from 11 to maybe $16 million of space left.
Do you think that's what they're going to do with Welker? Is that what the indications are?
Well, I think – I don't think – well, you see, there's a couple lines of thought. One is that the Patriots may not want to, if Welker's looking for a big deal, $7-9 million per year for 4 or 5 years, the general consensus is that the Patriots are not going to offer him that size of contract. I guess the logic behind that would be that they don't believe that Welker is as valuable to other teams around the league as he is to them. That is to say that maybe he's more of a product of the offensive system and of having a quarterback like Tom Brady than he is, you know, a player in the mold of a Calvin Johnson or a Larry Fitzgerald who can simply just physically beat coverages, beat defensive players and defensive schemes by their sheer size, athleticism, speed, and all that. So their thinking may be that, you know, he's not that type of player, so he's not, therefore, not worth that large amount of offense. I believe he's 31 years old, so he is kind of getting up, you know, towards the end of his career for a player that depends so much on his quickness and his burst. You know, those are generally the things that you see start to go as the player gets older at the wide receiver position. You know, so I think they're going to try and so there's a couple options. They can either just say, all right, we're going to franchise you $9 million next year, but no contract after that, which could lead to a holdout situation, which they went through with Mankins 2 years ago, where he might not show up at least for training camp, potentially parts of the regular season. So that's not ideal. Or they could offer him a lower contract, maybe somewhere in the range of $4, $5, $6 million a year. Maybe try and be flexible with how they lock up the guaranteed money, whether it's roster bonuses and stuff like that, so they can keep his cap number down, which gives them some room to go out and sign some other players. And some people are even saying that they're going to let him go to they're going to let him just test the free agent market. They're not going to franchise him. They'll say, see what you can get out there, but just give us a chance to match the number. And that kind of plays back into the whole idea of he's not as valuable to another team as he is to the Patriots. So maybe he's going to go out there. Some team will offer him $5, $6 million a year, and they'll say, all right, you went out, you had your chance at the free agent market. That was the biggest number that you can get. We'll sign you. We'll match the deal that whoever else was going to give you.
That's the one that makes the most sense to me, because a lot of the discussions I hear, they make it sound like, you know, he has a lot of the leverage in this. But to me, like you just described, this is not a guy who's just going to go and put up those stats anywhere. And, you know, even to me, the franchise number seems high. I mean, $9 million.
That's a big number. I mean, think about, you know, does a player like Calvin Johnson command that type of money?
Yes.
Probably. You know, like, yes. You know, he's a guy that can just single-handedly take over a game. You know, Welker is, you know, more – I feel like he's a great player in this offense, a great player. You can't argue with his production. He's been maybe the most productive receiver in the league for the last 5 years in terms of receptions and yardage and things like that. There's no doubt that he's an essential piece of this offense, that him and Brady are so well connected on the same page that taking him out of this offense would probably be, you know, would probably cause a lot of dysfunction, at least at first going forward. So, you know, and you see that, you know, guys, I believe the Steelers just kind of did the same thing with Wallace, where they're letting him go to free agency as a restricted free agent.
But I think that Wallace, and, you know, maybe I'm just trying to think as a GM, looking at the tape, thinking about my offense. I mean, Wallace is one of the fastest receivers in the league.
Right.
He's tall. He's fast. He's younger than Welker. You know, that's a guy who I feel like he could come in and make an impact in a lot of different systems. Whereas with Welker, and don't get me wrong, he's great at what he does. But there are a lot of offenses where, you know, I mean, like he could come in and play Victor Cruz's spot. I mean, I wouldn't want him to, but I'm saying, you know, that's an offense where he could come in and do that. But a lot of offenses, I don't think he's that valuable. I think, you know, it's exactly what you said. I mean, if other teams aren't going to pay more than $6 million for him, why would the Patriots pay $9 million? And I would even question, you know, there's going to be guys out there and they're going to have money. You know, there's going to be your Brandon Lloyds, your Mike Wallace's, who could really put you in a good position outside the numbers. I mean, could a guy like Julian Edelman step in and give you 70%, 80% of Welker's production?
Well, I think that's the thinking. And a lot of people believe that Edelman could, you know, could come in and replace at least most of that production. Then you think about the fact that Hernandez is essentially a slot receiver himself. You know, between those two guys, can they equal what what goes on with Welker, that remains to be seen. You know, Welker basically commanded the one-on-one coverage of secondary's best inside defender during every game. So, you know, on the one hand, you have the fact that maybe Hernandez, Edelman, some of these other receivers' numbers are a little bit inflated simply by the fact that the best defender was usually locked on Welker in the slot. But, you know, again, I think that the $9.4 million is probably more than they're willing to pay for Welker, even given as much as he's done for this team and as productive a player as he's been. I think they'd like to see that number get down in the $5, $6 million range. And if they can lock him up for that for 3 or 4 years, I don't see why they wouldn't do it. You know, and you mentioned Mike Wallace, and there's a guy that I think the Patriots should absolutely look into, because at, I believe he's only 26 or 27, maybe not even, maybe 25 or 26. But if you look statistically at his first 3 years in the league, his numbers are on par with, you know, some of the greatest wide receivers in the game in terms of receptions and yardage production-wise. And the Patriots with two first-round picks, you know, that's one of the things that's going to be hard for a lot of teams to deal with, is the fact that if they do go out and sign Wallace, they're going to have to forfeit a pick to Pittsburgh in the first round of this year's draft. The Patriots have two first rounders. Now, you know, on one hand, Wallace is going to command a larger deal than a first round draft pick is going to. But, you know, when you're sitting there with two first rounders, two second rounders, and you can say, listen, we can give up one of these first round picks and we can go out and sign one of the best young wide receivers in the game. You know, a guy who can really stretch the field, great speed, has had great production, even in an offense where, you know, they're still a very physical run-oriented team. And, you know, Pittsburgh, I believe, had like the lowest number of offensive possessions in the league last year. And so if you look at his numbers and you say, listen, what could he do on a team like the Patriots who are, you know, so prolific on offense? I mean, you can really start to kind of go crazy over it. But, you know, he's a guy I think that the Patriots would be willing to go after because of his age, because of the speed, the type of wide receiver that he is, and because of the fact that they have the two first-round picks, gives them a little bit of room to, you know, either to they could trade one of those picks and still go ahead and have a pick in the first round and then two in the second. So,
half the time they don't even use those first-round picks.
Right. I mean, there's almost – I'd be almost shocked if they didn't trade out of the first round, pick up somebody else's first round pick next year, and another second or third, fourth round pick during this year's draft. But I think that's something that's interesting. They're in a good situation for a player like Wallace, who a lot of teams simply won't be able to go out and get just because of the fact that they had to sacrifice that number one draft pick, in addition to the money that he's going to command as a free agent. So, you know, It's tough these last few days before the things start to kind of happen here to keep speculating. But, you know, I'd like to see Welker come back. And I think that if they can work something out, some sort of a deal, that they will go out and make a move for other wide receivers. Because if we look at some of the other guys who are going to be probably coming off the roster this year, Ocho Cinco, the Patriots have already talked to him about restructuring his deal because I believe he was due $4 or $5 million, millions of dollars basically, for a guy who caught about 23 balls last year, really didn't play in most of the games. There's no way that they'll bring him back for that kind of money. Deion Branch is another guy who probably doesn't have much value for any other team. I mean, just a guy who kind of burned out in Seattle, but has had such great success with Brady. You know, he's been in the league now 10 years, so he's getting up there in age as well. I don't think they're going to really want to lock up any money in him to bring him back. But if Branch and Ocho Cinco are willing to take, you know, veteran minimum deals to play in New England, I think that, I think there's a good possibility that those guys will be back, at least for some experience and depth. It remains to be seen whether Ocho Cinco's going to want to do that. You know, it's hard to say, really. You know, he certainly said and did all the right things throughout the year, but it was a strange season for him, and it had to be a little bit difficult. You know, there's a lot of speculation that Brady just straight out doesn't trust the guy. They never really looked in sync, even after an entire season Now, granted, there was no off season last year, so it's tough to say what might have been able to have been accomplished had those guys had the chance to work together and really learn the system in the off season rather than on the fly. So that one's a little up in the air. I wouldn't be surprised to see Branch come back for some kind of a minimum deal. And then the other wide receiver free agent is Matthew Slater, the Pro Bowl special teamer. I think he's a guy who will be a priority for this team. Because he's such an important part of the special teams, kick coverages, kick returns, and, you know, not a terrible wide receiver, just has never really been a big part of this offense, and I don't anticipate he will going forward. But, you know, Belichick certainly appreciates good special teams players, guys like Larry Izzo, another guy who's a free agent this year, linebacker Tracy White, guys who really their contributions only come in the special teams game, but are very important to this team and won't command a ton of money. I think those guys will be back. So wide receiver is a place where they need to make a move, obviously. Especially if they don't sign Welker, they're going to have to go out and probably get one free agent and then draft a guy high in this year's draft. From everything that's been coming out of Indianapolis, this is a draft that's fairly deep with wide receivers. But the Patriots don't have a good history of drafting wideouts. You know, Deion Branch is really the last guy that they hit on in 2002, and since then they've had a lot of guys who just didn't pan out. And you know, it's always fun to go back in hindsight and look at who the Patriots drafted, and then look at who was selected later on. You know, they took Brandon Tate a couple years ago. Mike Wallace was a guy who was drafted, you know, the next pick after him. So they could already have had Wallace. Greg Jennings was a guy that they lip-slipped through. So there's been a lot of guys. You know, Brandon Lloyd, a guy that everybody's talking about bringing in now, was another guy that had a chance to draft and didn't. So they haven't hit on the wide receivers very well in the draft. So that's one thing that makes me a little skeptical. I'd almost rather see them go out and get a proven commodity as opposed to taking a risk on a guy they're going to have to develop, especially given the inability of a lot of guys who've come in from other places around the league to pick up the system, to get on the same page with Brady. So I'm almost leaning towards moving in the free agency and using those picks on defense and other places.
Now, it sounds like you'd rather have Wallace than Lloyd, but if that doesn't work, is Brandon Lloyd someone you'd be interested in?
Absolutely. You know, I think that the fact that he played with McDaniels, he basically bounced around with McDaniels from Denver to St. Louis and has said a lot of things about being a McDaniels guy and wanting to play for him. So he knows somewhat of the offense, which makes me a little bit more optimistic about him being able to come in and pick it up. Certainly the speed of Wallace and the fact that he's really such a game changer on the outside is exciting because we've been missing that in the last couple of years since Moss left. The one issue with Lloyd that people around here are talking about is that his agent apparently doesn't have a good relationship with the Patriots, which stems all the way back to the fact that he represented Ben Watson back when he was a rookie. There was some issues with negotiating Watson's contract. Basically, the Patriots wanted Watson to sign a 6-year deal, like the rest of their rookies had been doing. This agent wanted Watson to sign a 4-year deal because he was older than most of the other players in the draft or that the Patriots had signed. And the long and short of it is that the agent ended up having to fire himself so that Watson could be hired because there was such bad blood. And I guess that since that point in time, this particular agent and his agency, which represents about 150 players around the league, has not done a single deal with New England. And has spoken openly about the fact that they consider the league to be a 31-team league and that the Patriots essentially treat their agency's players like they don't exist. You know, in the grand scheme of things, I think it all comes down to money in the end, right?
Right.
I mean, if the Patriots wanted one of these guys and the guy wants to play for the Patriots, I don't see why there's not going to be a deal done. But there is a little bit of history there, which makes some people skeptical about the fact that Brandon Lloyd could potentially sign with the Patriots. You know, I think that's a little bit overrated, but again, it's something to be considered. You know, you never know the inner workings of these back rooms and how much animosity really gets carried around. I mean, it seems ridiculous in a sense because you're going to want to put the best players on the field regardless of who's representing them. But, you know, that's something that's out there and to be considered, you know. So
I've heard some scenarios where they end up bringing in both those guys. I think that's pretty unlikely, but
Lloyd, you know, and Wallace, or Lloyd and Welker.
Well, where they bring in Lloyd and Wallace, and Welker's gone, and Edelman's in the slot.
Well, I think that, yeah, I mean, you're only going to be able to get two out of the three, I think. And on the one hand, I think the fact that you already have Welker on your team, you probably have a little bit more room to negotiate his contract down than I would think you might with a guy coming in from another team. Although that hasn't always been the case with New England. Guys have seemed pretty open to wanting to come here because of the simple fact that they're going to have a chance to win. You know, they know that they're going to be a part of a winning team. So two out of those three guys, I think I would take any day of the week. Any combination of the three, really, when you consider the players that they have at tight end, and the fact that, you know, with a few low money guys like an Edelman or a Branch, you know, filling in the gaps, they should be in pretty good shape. So, nice. I mean, so that's the wide receiver situation. I mean, just quickly going over the offense, there's a couple older guys on the offensive line. Dan Copen, who was injured for the season, is a free agent. Dan Connolly, who's a center guard, a guy who's kind of a, you know, utility lineman who stepped in and played excellent the entire year at center when Copen went down. I think Connolly will be back. Copen, who's an older guy, and whose play had somewhat slipped, you know, prior to the season to begin with, is a guy who I think they maybe will bring back at a lower money number. But at the same time, I don't think they're going to go out and give him a big deal at this point, considering how well the backups played on that offensive line. You know, Matt Light is a guy who's people are talking about maybe considering retirement. I think he's coming off actually one of the best seasons of his career, which is surprising. The only issue is that, you know, he's due a pretty large amount of money. I think $5 or $6 million this next year. And they've got a guy, Nate Solder, who they drafted last year, who's really the tackle of the future on the left side. And I think they're going to want him to start playing more. So if maybe Light restructures, and comes back at a smaller number, plays more of a backup role so that Solder can kind of step into that starting role. But other than that, they're in pretty good shape on that offensive line. Solder did play a great amount last year. He played well. Marcus Cannon is another guy who didn't get a lot of time but was recovering from lymphoma and really didn't get into the swing of things until the end of the season.
Cannon's he's the guy from TCU?
That's correct, yeah. Yes. And he's a big guy, and they're pretty high on him from what people are saying out of the Patriots organization. He actually played guard in college, but his size is more of tackle size. So he's a guy that you could consider maybe for a right tackle spot. Mankins is locked up. Brian Waters is a guy who an older guy but played great for the Patriots last year, was a Pro Bowl player, loved it in New England. I wouldn't be surprised to see him back. So, but at the same point in time, I think they will go out and take at least one or two guys in the draft, probably later in the rounds, to shore up that offensive line. But I think overall they're pretty good. The only other figures are running back. You know, Green Ellis is the guy who's a free agent, and that's kind of a question mark because he could command a couple million dollars from another team around the league. They've had him for a bargain of, you know, a couple hundred thousand at this point, and they did draft two running backs in last year's draft. And Ridley looks like he's probably the guy who's going to step in and be the number one. So Green Ellis maybe is a guy who will be gone unless he, you know, is willing to take a hometown discount. And Kevin Falk, who didn't dress for the Super Bowl, will most likely retire.
And Woodhead's still under contract?
Woodhead's still under contract. And then you have the two rookies, Vereen and Ridley. So with those three guys, you know, with Woodhead, you've got kind of your prototypical third down back, a guy who's a good receiver. And then Ridley's more of a, you know, your running traditional running back. Vereen didn't really get a lot of time last year, but he's supposedly a very explosive player, and will be a good asset to that offense. So I think on the offensive side of the ball, they're pretty well set. You know, and if you look at the defense, there's not really any big names that are up for for contracts right now, it's a lot of these guys who have were plugged in. You know, we have our two defensive ends, Anderson and Carter, are both free agent. Anderson, a little bit of the older player. I doubt he'll be back, but Carter is a guy who really played great for the Patriots, ended up leading the team in sacks. So I believe he'll be back. And Sean Ellis.
That's impressive because he missed a lot of the year, right?
Well, no, Carter actually played most of the year. He was injured in the playoffs, tore his quadricep against Baltimore.
Oh, right.
Okay. So he wasn't out in the Super Bowl, but he, you know, he did. Both those guys had played well at times, but they are older players. They're not a long-term solution. And there's a lot of guys on that defensive line. Sean Ellis, who will be gone, I believe, because he's, you know, he was given $4 million last year and basically didn't do much of anything. I thought he would be a much better fit for his team. So quite honestly, I was pretty surprised that he didn't play better or have more production this year. You got Gerard Warren, who's just another effective interior lineman in the mold of a Vince Wilfork and a Kyle Love, just one of those big guys taking up space in the middle of the 3-4. And then we've got a lot of guys in the secondary, you know, who were really just role players. You know, Nate Johns, Antoine Molden, James Ahedebo, Brett Lockett, guys who I don't think are legitimate number ones around the league. I think that when the Patriots go into the draft, I think that they really need to go out and get a safety. I'd really like to see them go after, you know, maybe Mark Barron, the guy out of Alabama. Everybody knows about Belichick and Saban's great connection. They played together in a pro-am golf tournament this year. I'm hoping that they were just talking about how good a fit Barron might be for the secondary, because all year long, free safety was just a huge gaping hole in this defense. It hurt the play of the cornerbacks. I think it really hurt Devin McCourty, who had kind of a sophomore slump. So I think that if they get better down the middle of that defense, particularly at the safety spot, they'll be in much better shape. And then I think maybe cornerback, you know, a lot of people are talking about, you know, a guy like Janoris Jenkins, who's got, you know, all kinds of off-the-field issues. He's another one of these guys like Cromartie.
He's good, though, man.
He's great. I mean, most people were predicting him almost to be a lottery pick, you know, throughout the first 3 years of his career at Florida. Gets basically forced to leave, ends up playing his senior year in Northern Alabama. He's one of these guys who's got like four different kids and five different women. He's got a lot of different problems with drugs off the field incidents. So he's a guy who might fall, you know, and the Patriots are a team who, you know, I think like to look for players like that whose draft stock may be down a little bit.
And what a great fit for guys like that, I think, to go there, because it just seems like a place where they don't have – there aren't all the same pitfalls of if they were going to New York City or to Dallas, just in terms of the surroundings. And I think there's a lot of good guys on that team who you can – you know, you can sort of take him under their wing. I don't know. To me, I want to see that kid do well, because I just think, you know, just on, you know, for the same reason I'd like to see Dwayne Wade and LeBron James win a championship. I just think guys who are really, really talented, who are that enjoyable to watch, I want to see their talents go as far as they can. And I think the Patriots would be a really good fit for him to really have success in the NFL.
Right. And you know, they do have a good – they have a good locker room right now, in terms of veteran leadership, the way that the organization's run. You know, they've shown that they can bring in guys who people perceive to be, you know, issues players, and they can either make them work or they cut them loose and the team is none the worse for it. If you look what happened with Albert Haynesworth, I think there's a lot of situations where a guy like that coming in could really destroy a team's locker room, could really shake things up. And, you know, you almost forgot about it by, you know, a week after the guy was gone, that he was even on the team. And it was such a big story coming into the preseason, the fact that the Patriots had brought this guy in. And, you know, life goes on. You plug in another guy and you keep moving forward. And, you know, those types of things, those changes, those moves where they bring a guy in, he'll either fit in or he won't. And, you know, the team's able to move on and not get caught up in any of that stuff, which has been, you know, part of why they've been able to be so successful over the years, because you have to take chances on these guys, right? I mean, when the opportunity comes for an extremely talented player with off the field issues or some kind of, you know, non-football issues, if you're not willing to go out and take a chance on that guy, then you're going to miss out on a lot of victories. I mean, look what happened with Randy Moss. A lot of people didn't even want to touch Randy Moss when he came to the Patriots, and he came and had 23 touchdowns the next year.
And the guy, you know, you go back to the draft even with him, you know,
right.
This guy, greatest college wide receiver. I mean, I might even say greatest college player I've ever seen.
Right.
And, you know, he slips to the end of the first round and, you know, goes on and has a Hall of Fame career. And I think there's something – I think people say – well, you can't expect these guys to change. And I don't necessarily agree with that, because there is a big change, which is that if you're talking about Jenkins and all his problems at Florida, you're talking about a guy who was, you know, the king of the castle as soon as he got to Gainesville, even beforehand, you know, and
right.
He came in and you're treated almost like a god, feels like you kind of have free reign over everything. And the NFL is different. I mean, you know, he's going to be a huge step up. You have to prove yourself. As soon as you do slip up, you're gone. And I think the other big thing is, I mean, the money. I mean, this is – we're talking about chance to make millions and millions of dollars to totally change the trajectory of your life and your kid's life. And, you know, I mean, having those kids, I mean, that's got to be something that – that's got to be a pretty heavy weight on him. I mean, I just think that getting to the NFL, I don't think you can assume that these guys aren't going to – take their responsibilities a little more seriously, because it's not going to be as easy for them, and they know how much money is at stake.
Right. You know, that's the biggest thing. And there will be guys who flame out and can't rise to that situation. And certainly in some franchises where, you know, the benefit of coming into a place like a New England or a New York, the Giants, or, you know, a franchise that's got a history of winning, it's got a strong veteran presence in the locker room. You know, some teams don't have that luxury, and some teams will have to take risks on players without that kind of infrastructure to support the player. Or at the same time, the fact that the player is going to such a bad team that he's really thrust into the spotlight before he's ready. And that can be a big setback as well. I mean, if you got the right coaching and the right system in place, and, like, you know, if the guy's good enough, he can play right away. But if not, you don't need to rush his progression to the point that it ultimately hurts him as a player in terms of his confidence or his, you know, his ability to perform on the field. So the Patriots are in a good situation, because I feel like they've got the system in place to take a risk on a player with a character issues. And I mean, people forget that Aaron Hernandez was a guy who coming out of Florida had some off the field issues, and a lot of people had red flagged him as a guy with character problems.
He's from hard hitting New Britain.
That's right. Right down the road from Avon.
That's right.
There's a lot of good football talent that's come out of that little area there.
Yeah,
Dwight Freeney.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely.
New Britain too. So the Patriots could take a risk on a guy like that, who's got great talent and big upside. You know, if they can grab him at the end of the first round, or maybe even with one of those second round picks, I'd like to see that. You know, and then there are in the free agency, we haven't talked much about, you know, the defensive side of the ball in free agency. Obviously, the guy that everybody's talking about is Mario Williams. And the fact of the matter is, the Patriots may have the room to make a play for Mario Williams, given the way that they've set up the salary cap, and depending on what they do on the offensive side of the ball, there's a chance that they could make a play for him. Another guy who I think that they will take a long, hard look at is Cliff Averill, defensive end in Detroit. He's a guy who went to Purdue and was one of those outside linebacker, you know, D-end hybrid type players in college, and the Patriots have had like 12 of those guys from Purdue on their roster in the last few years. They just really seem to like, you know, guys coming out of that system.
I thought the Lions were gonna franchise him.
Then
he said if they franchised him, he'd hold out. Never mind, that's what happened.
Right. Okay. I mean, I couldn't remember honestly what other free agents they had, because the team only gets one franchise per offseason now. Is that the deal?
Yep.
Okay, so
it's actually a lower number now because it used to just be the average of the top five salaries. Now it's the top five over the previous five seasons. So that number came down slightly.
Yep. So if he's franchise, I mean, I would think that Detroit's going to want to keep him on that defensive line. But that's another guy who I think the Patriots will be looking at if he slips through the cracks or if Detroit lets him go to free agency. And again, because of the fact that they have those four picks in the first two rounds, they have a little bit of flexibility to go after restricted guys or guys that require compensation. So you have Williams, you have Averill. In the secondary, Deshaun Goldson is a guy in San Francisco who's a free agent. I don't know if the 49ers could franchise him.
I would love it if you guys got him out of San Francisco.
Yeah, I would love it too, man. Because I think safety, in my opinion, safety is the number one priority for this team, either in free agency or the draft. I think that'll have the most impact on their defense. Pass rushing thing, I mean, they got pretty good production out of these guys, Carter and Anderson, who they basically took off the street. Nobody else was really interested in. You know, a guy like Mario Williams, who's really going into the prime of his career right now and statistically has been one of the most dominant defensive linemen in the history of the game. If you look at his numbers, his sacks per game, you know, the percentage of his team sacks that he's made up for. And he's just had, in the last year or two, actual decent players playing on that defensive line with him. I mean, that Houston Texans defensive line is monstrous. I mean, when you look at J.J. Watt, Connor Barwin, Williams – I mean, that's a scary defense if they're all healthy. But he's going to command a big salary. The Patriots took a big risk on Adales Thomas, and that was a complete disaster. You know, so they've shown that they would go out and pay for these guys occasionally. But the question is, you know, what do they think about Williams and his fit in the defense, and can they make the money work? I mean, if they could make that happen – it would be amazing.
I like the Averill move kind of too, though, because to me that is – it is, like you said, it seems like a good fit for what they like. And I feel like the production is not significantly worse for what – and I think the money might be significantly less.
Right. That's kind of – I think that's kind of like the sneaky backdoor free agent signing. A guy who could really be that productive. And like you said, what's the difference between, you know, 0.7 sacks per game and 0.55 sacks per game? You know, and over the course of the season, it's going to be three or four sacks. And certainly a guy like Williams is commanding a double team every play. And Averill has certainly had the benefit of playing alongside Dominican Sue, who's also probably commanding a double team on most plays.
Right.
So anytime you're a defensive lineman – who's playing next to a truly dominant player, I feel like your numbers are going to be a little bit higher anyway, simply from the fact that there's only so many guys that they can send to block on any given play.
And but in New England, you're going to have Wilfork in the middle too.
Exactly. So that I mean, that's and that's a little bit different too, I think, than like a Williams, you know, is a guy who plays mostly on the outside as opposed to a guy on the inside. So that's going to change a little bit of the way the schemes that people use to stop to block you. But, I mean, it's a good situation for a talented pass rusher, and they really haven't had a guy who physically has the skills of a Williams or an Averill, you know, any of those good outside pass rushers, you know, since Richard Seymour, who is a little bit different in a sense too because he's really a defensive tackle who is great at getting to the quarterback. So it would be nice to get somebody with those kind of talents playing alongside Wilfork and Love and some of those other guys and those big bodies in the middle. And it's you know, people in New England, man, it's like every draft, everybody, all they talk about is pass rusher, pass rusher, pass rusher. And it starts to drive you crazy after a little while because you know, there's not a ton of those guys out there for one thing, and you can win games without having a dominant pass rusher. I mean, DeMarcus Ware is probably statistically one of the greatest pass rushers of all time, you know, and the Cowboys have won one playoff game in like the last 8 years. You know, so and you look
I think they've won zero.
Right, I mean, it's something ridiculous like that. Since Romo's been quarterback, I think they've only won one playoff game.
I think it's zero.
Zero. So that even goes to show. I mean, and where's a guy who averages like a sack a game? You know, statistically, when you look at how those guys break down, I mean, he's one of the all-time great in terms of production-wise. But that alone is not going to win you. Not going to win you a championship. I mean, you need to have different types of players. I mean, if you look at like the Giants' defensive line, they're strong, you know, across the board. They don't just have an edge rusher. You know, they have an edge rusher and an interior rusher, you know, or a strong guy against the run inside and, you know, athletic guys on the outside. It really has to work as a whole unit. And the Patriots have been really good at finding guys who other teams don't particularly value because of the type of defense that they play and just because of the things that they're looking for them to do aren't necessarily to just rush a gap and try and get into the backfield, but, you know, play the two-gap defense, hold up blockers. They've had good success. You know, I think that if the Patriots could get better in the secondary, that's going to help out their pass rush quite a great deal. You know, that's a two-way street. Good pass rush will help your secondary. Good secondary will help your pass rush. But I think if you have better cornerbacks than defensive linemen, I think more often than not, that's a better balance of power on your defense because you make that quarterback hold the ball just a little bit longer. Most of those, you'll be able to get much more pressure just from that fact alone. You know.
Can I interrupt for a second? I stand corrected. In 2009, the Cowboys defeated the Eagles in the first round, and that was their only postseason win since 1996. They lost in the next round to the Vikings. I must have just blocked out of my mind the fact that the Cowboys and Eagles were playing each other in the playoffs.
Yeah, I can understand why that might be a little bit difficult for you. But, I mean, that just goes to show, right? I mean, that's 16 years with one playoff win.
Yeah, and it's not just the DeMarcus Ware thing. It's all over. They've got all this money invested in these big names. And that's why, you know, I think you're right about Mario Williams. I think the production is there. I don't think you're overpaying for, you know, past services or anything like that. I mean, particularly the fact that he had to sit out this year and it's, you know, a torn pectoral muscle, I believe. So I don't think that will be anything that holds him back. Right. But, you know, it makes me nervous to think about bringing in guys who have been the biggest attraction in where they've been before just because that type of personality has the potential, and maybe when I think about the Patriots, I just can't get the Adelius Thomas thing out of my head. But yep. I'm just thinking, like, God, if they could go back, I don't know who, you know, if Adelius Thomas is Mario Williams, I don't know who the equivalent of Averill would have been that year. But, you know, if you can get your biggest names to be homegrown and add the really strong complementary pieces in free agency, I think that's the best way to do it. But look, Mario Williams, I don't know anything. Obviously, if you can get him, you should get him, and he'll probably be great. And
yeah,
you
I mean,
know,
you,
I don't see why he would fall in line with New England. Yeah,
you have to at least kick the tires on that one. You know, yeah. I mean, see what you can do because I think clearly, it's a guy that just jumps off the tape at you and says, I mean, this guy's a legit game changer for a defense. You know,
and if he didn't get disgruntled in Houston, he's not going to get disgruntled in New England.
No, I mean, certainly. If you consider what it was like for him playing his first few years in the league, probably being blocked by three guys every time and not winning a lot of games. Yeah, I mean, it'll be interesting to see what kind of money he commands. You know, and it's exciting to see, you know, the days on the calendar fly by, you know, getting closer and closer to these things, you know, starting to shake out. So,
yeah.
I mean, it's an interesting time. I mean, we're only days away here, I guess, from the Manning decision.
Yep.
You know, which will be exciting as well. And, you know, a lot of things kind of hanging in the balance. I mean, it's funny to think about how much the power structure in the league can shift, you know, at least in terms of our perception over the next few weeks, you know, because you know, look what happened with the Philadelphia Eagles last year is a perfect example. They were the hot team in free agency. They made all the big splashes. They signed Asamoah. They went out and they got Jenkins from Green Bay. You know, big names all across the board. They made a big deal with Cobb. They brought in some more guys in the secondary, and they didn't even make the playoffs. So you have to temper your expectations, I think, a little bit. You have to, you know, try and maintain, keep your feet on solid ground here as some of these moves go on, because it, you know, ultimately it's like the teams that are good will continue to be good because, you know, their success doesn't hinge on the signing or the unsigning of one particular player, you know, or yeah, one superstar player.
Well, when you look at it, I mean, take a look at championship game weekend, right? We had all these different big moves, but at the end of the day, we had, you know, in the AFC, the Patriots, who made a few very low-risk moves before the season started, and then you had the Ravens, who, you know, pretty much had the key players on that roster all intact. I guess they brought Lee Evans in, but it's not like he was a major contributor. And then in the NFC, you had the Giants, who fans were pulling their hair out because they didn't make any moves. And, you know, the 49ers, who, I mean, that was supposed to be like – that was not even supposed to be – that team wasn't even on the radar. You know what I mean? That team was like, wow, this is – they got Harbaugh. That's going to be good. They've got some good young players, but this is going to be a long rebuilding process. And, you know, so like you said, you never know. And it's not an overnight thing. There's just – there's too many positions on the field for one or two guys to really take – unless it's a quarterback – to really take you to the promised land.
Yeah. It's so. I mean, that's one of the things I think when you look at the Giants and the Patriots franchises. You know, sometimes they'll go out and make those big moves. More of the time, not. So sometimes draft day and free agency can be a little bit tough as Patriots fans because it's not like we're the biggest and throw money at the. And if you look at it, you know, Warner was injured in a playoff game against the Saints in 2010. And this was apparently during the time that all this stuff was going on. So that's certainly interesting. That'll shake things up in New Orleans. And I would imagine that there'll be some sort of sanctions against the Saints for that activity. And you're looking at maybe potential draft picks, I would have to think, considering the reaction that the league took with the Patriots when they were, you know, accused of spying on their opponents using video recording devices. I would have to think that this – is a more serious infraction, paying your players to injure other teams.
See, I was about to say I don't think it is.
Absolutely, the videotaping of signals. You know, we could get into it. I don't really want to go too into how far I feel about it, but I feel like everybody can see the signals anyway. They're on the sidelines for people to see when they're giving the signals into the games. So I don't feel like that's necessarily such a bad thing. I think that with all the impetus that the league has put on player safety in the last 2 years, with the head-to-head hits, the defenseless receiver, the fines, the suspensions and things of that nature that have gone along with that, I think when you look at something that was an organizational issue where coaches and players were openly discussing money for injuring an opponent, that you absolutely have to take come down hard on this type of stuff if you want people to not laugh you out of the building when you say we're our number one concern is player safety.
Yeah, that's true. Don't get me wrong. I think there'll be serious consequences. I just think, you know, when we talked about all the time, when you're playing against Aaron Rodgers and he's got cracked ribs, you're saying, okay, we need to get big hits on him and make him so that he's trying to get rid of the ball more quickly. And you're saying, you know, Kyle Williams has had concussions. We want to get solid hits on him so that, you know, he might not be as keen on his punt returns. And I realize this is different because this is actually, oh, you injured that player. Here's money. But, you know, I think it's still trying to encourage your players to be thinking about getting big hits on guys, whereas – you know, and I agree it does more damage. I'm not saying, you know, I don't think the Patriots benefited that much from their from this whole Spygate thing. But it is an actual infraction of, like, the rules in the rule book. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I wouldn't argue with that. I would just say that from a PR standpoint.
Oh, yeah, you got to bring the hammer down for sure.
You absolutely do. I mean, and this is, you know, this is something that was obviously involving coaching staff and stuff of that nature. So, I mean, it's like we talked about when we talked about the Williams thing. It's something that we know is a part of the game. It's a physical game. You are trying. I mean, as Ray Lewis is famous for quoting, said that he tries to take people's souls when he hits them. I mean, there's no joking about the fact that these are serious men trying to do serious things to serious people. You know, like they're trying to, you know, take your will to live, in a sense, but it can't be talked about, right? I mean, that's the line that these players walk. Like, they're supposed to say that they, you know, say the right things and do the right things, even though we're paying to watch these guys destroy each other on the field, you know? So, yeah. But it's like, and everybody knows that. Of course, people are trying to take out the other team's quarterback. Of course, you're trying to hit him as hard as you can. But you can't talk about it, and you certainly can't pay or take money for it. Yeah.
And I'd like to think, I mean, you know, it's bad for the league when people get injured. And I just think, definitely, you know,
especially your star quarterback, right?
Right. And, you know? And I think, and that's where it gets to the point, as a player, you're competitive. You need to sort of be in this dark place going into the game where, you know, you're not treating this person like your friend or like your colleague, obviously. But, you know, in terms of what's good for the league, what's good for the fans, who are actually the people who are keeping your job, you know, they want to have all of the great players playing. So I think the narrative always needs to be and should be, when somebody gets hurt, you know, we want to put hard hits on guys. We want to make them get rid of the ball earlier. We do not want people to get injured. And I do think they believe that off the field. So I think to have coaches say to them, hey, nice job, you know, putting Kurt Warner out of the game. Here's the money. And especially when it gets to the point of, like, you're talking about a dangerous thing, like you said, with the receivers, where if it's like, hey, we're going to give you $100,000 if you knock Calvin Johnson out. And you know, Calvin Johnson ends up paralyzed, and a coach is giving out $100,000 to a player. I mean, that's
yep.
That's
almost like organizing a hit. You know, like that's almost criminal, in my opinion.
Yeah,
you know,
no,
when you talk about seriously injuring a guy like that, and that's the potential. I mean, certainly you can be hurt on any particular play playing football. You know, that's just a reality of the game, and maybe. Maybe the money has nothing to do with it, but as soon as that story's out there, as soon as that becomes a part of the discussion, you can't put it back in the box, you know?
Right.
And there's no way to remove that, you know, from whatever incident.
I don't even think it's the money. I think it could be if you have any kind of token economy going for this. So it could be freaking
token economy.
Yeah. It could be Jolly Ranchers. You know? It could be Jolly Ranchers. And it doesn't
matter.
That's
unbelievable.
These guys
I'm going to use that. I like that. Token of con.
Yeah, these guys are...
You're an educator, though, so I guess you should know things like that.
These guys are competitive, and they're, you know, it doesn't matter. If one of them has gotten 20 and someone else has only gotten 2, that's still... You know, that's still something that they're going to want and that they're going to want to get. And so I agree with you. I mean, absolutely. With the size of these guys, with how fast they're able to run, with the fact that there are times when players are in precarious situations and we have specific rules in place to prevent them from getting, you know, life-threatening injuries from these precarious situations, you cannot have teams, you know, because a coach can, you know, I mean – again, a lot of times when it's quarterbacks, when it's hitting quarterbacks and things like that, I really think you don't have the time to try to injure them. I really think it's about getting really solid hits on them, which you're going to do anyways. But I agree. I think the receiver thing is where it can get a little dicey. And you can't have coaches encouraging the players to take dirty hits and to be spearing them in that situation. And you can't certainly have something set up to encourage it. And so I agree. They need to come down hard. I just meant – So, and I do think it's more serious than the Spygate thing. I just meant in terms of like an actual rules infraction. I don't know if it violates the rules to the extent of the Patriots, but certainly I don't think the Patriots really benefited from Spygate. And I think that this has potential to do a lot more damage.
Absolutely. So we'll see how it shakes out. And,
well, man, that was the first time we've ever had productive conversation on this show after the 1 hour mark.
I know. Usually we've totally dissolved into utter mediocrity in terms of the discussion, or just total random stuff. So we should probably quit while we're ahead.
Yeah.
We are over the hour mark. We have talked all I feel like we've gone through the Patriots offseason stuff up until, you know, obviously the next few weeks things will shake out a little bit more for both of our teams, for stuff around the league. And we'll probably start getting into basketball, I guess, at some point.
Next week, I think, I mean, you know, we might have some moves coming down the pike next week. And so if there are big NFL moves, we'll talk about them. You know, we may have a Peyton Manning decision. And if not, we will have one, I guess, because March 6th, yeah. And we'll also talk about the Celtics and the NBA. That should be good. Last thing I'll close with really fast is I talked last week about how – our last show about how I wanted the Giants to re-sign Dominic Hixon because I thought that would be a guy who, if healthy, could replace Manningham. And they signed him yesterday. So Dominic Hixon is back and – you know, that
is this again, the is that the farewell for Manningham, in your opinion?
It all depends on what he's willing to take. There were rumors this week that he said he was 70% that he was going to leave, and then he came out and said that's not true. I'm about 50-50. Who knows? I mean, you know, they just throw these arbitrary numbers out there. It doesn't mean anything. It is all going to be about what he's offered. And I think he'll probably get offered something big just so some, you know, slapdick GM can show his team, look, I just went out and signed this Super Bowl hero, and that'll be it.
Well, you've used token economy and slapdick in a 5-minute period. I don't know if it's ever happened before in modern history. So we're going out on a high note.
There we go. All right, man. Have a good day.
Enjoy your Saturday.
All right.